The other thing that's always been strange to me is when people figure out maybe that what they've got isn't whole enough, they do just keep trying to pad on and they drag along all the fragments of the old era, that pulling in a little bit of royalty. I mean, like the reason we've got hierarchies is there's research actually proves people need other people to tell them what to do. Well, if you look at just one isolated impact, you could prove that, but it leaves out all of the things about humans.
Welcome to Business Second Opinion, the podcast that digs deep to answer hidden questions about business and business practice you may not know you need to be asking. We focus on how to discern whether advice and recommended best practices are actually good and useful. Too much is accepted without rigorous examination these days, but who has the time to do that research? We do. We do this rigorous digging for you and give you a second, most often a contrarian opinion to what's commonly accepted. We educate people on how to test and decide if what's offered as truth will give you the outcomes you really want without the side effects that they often include. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. How's it going, Carol?
Hi, Zach. It's all good.
What management practice are we looking at today?
Well, Zach, as you know, I've set up a Google Voice number for people to call and leave questions for us so that they can propose in a future podcast we pay attention. By the way, that number is 650-265-1193 or 6502-HUMAN. We got a question from a Microsoft leader who asked us about the science that's being offered for the new neuroscience studies brought into business. There's a group that's bringing that into their work, and being able to advocate it is the truth about leadership based on neuroscience and the study of human psychology. And they're using a group of scientists who are pretty extensively studying through resonant imaging, MRIs, how the brain works under certain conditions. It's called the Neural Leadership Institute, and they're good people. I believe they have some of the highest intentions of folks I know out there trying to matter. They have high-powered neuroscientists at top universities around the world, and they're citing those scientists' findings on research studies, and they're using, you know, the traditional scientific method, peer-reviewed, you know, repeat the studies. So you'd think that would be all they needed, right? But I think there's some underlying questions we need to examine before I was willing to tell this Microsoft leader that, yep, I give it my stamp of approval.
Yes, this is a great topic for today. Of all the podcasts and blogs I consume, there typically seems to be an impenetrable veil when people say science or this study showed or something to that effect that keeps people from truly questioning the methods being used to arrive at their allegedly infallible conclusions. So what's your question about around this, and how is Microsoft using this in a way that seems questionable for you?
I think that what the problem is, or the question I have, is how do you learn to become discriminating about research? Because we all, most of us are not researchers, we're not scientists. And so when someone tells us, well, this is scientifically proven, we tend to accept it. And what we don't know how to do is really discern what's behind it and the people who are interpreting it and telling us how it should work, whether or not they're full of it, right? But we just don't have a method to do it. We can't ask and understand what the actual framing of the research is. And I even add, you know, the mind of the researcher. And so I believe there are a lot of what I call first-class errors that are appearing, and there's people have no evident way to study them. I want to help with that.
But don't companies vet this stuff before it's introduced and in practice?
Well, they vet it in kind of the way I just said. They're vetting it, but in some ways it's way down the line. They find out how well it's working. They find out certain things aren't working. They keep trying to ameliorate and come up with some modifications. But what I want to do is propose a method to examine before you've spent all the money and gone to work on the research and are not just dependent on somebody else telling you it worked for them and it may not work for you. What's behind the research, the interpretations, the applications, and can we really help those researchers actually overcome the blindness they have by us beginning to ask them questions? So one way of asking this is, what worldview is shaping the research, the conduct of the study, the interpretation, the extrapolation, and I don't believe we can assume that scientific method is neutral, which is what is being assumed. I think it's far from neutral.
Wow, Carol, this is a big topic that we're going to wrestle to the ground today. So let me get this right, though. You mean researchers and practitioners are biased and cannot see their own biases? We've learned a lot about how very public companies are paid for and influence research findings that would favor their profit margins, from tobacco to sugar to automotive emissions. So is it fraud and deceit you're pointing to, or something else?
No, there's tons of that. And there are people who are doing that work. What I'm actually focusing on today are the people who have good intentions to find a truth that they can apply and that could be helpful, but they can't see how their own thinking is limited by these class one errors I talked about from the very outset. And it's really hard to compensate for them once you've started. So people who want to make people's lives better, support companies being more effective, a plan, a society that works, but they can't see their own mind well enough to see how they're off course from the beginning.
So you're saying people like me and the organizations I work with? So what is it we're missing exactly?
Well, I think it's this discernment ability to see what's behind it. People expect you to accept it on the surface, but the ability to see the worldview being used, and I have to talk about that. But let me first say there are kind of six times when research is being done where this kind of bias can show up, or this lack of discernment can show up. The first of those six phases is when we're actually trying to source ideas. And the second one is when we come up with a question or a hypothesis. And the third is when we decide we're going to actually develop a methodology and study it. Then the fourth is when we study it and we can impact it and intervene and make a difference even while we're doing it. And then there are the findings and the interpretation. And number six is how it is that it gets translated out. I learned about all of this, gosh, it was 50 years ago when I was working on my dissertation, and you had to do research, right? And so I was watching myself and noticing how my own mind was choosing not to consider certain things. And I thought, why is that? Where does it go? So I decided to study other doctoral students, and I had a hard time getting that approved for a while. But I had a couple dozen doctoral students who were in the throes of this mandated, scientifically validated study where you would accumulate all of it up into a dissertation and therefore bring forward new knowledge and potentially new practices. I was studying doctoral students in the fields of human science, psychology, education, social anthropology. I gave them a journal and I had them create these six phases where I talk about sourcing ideas, working on a research question, a hypothesis, designing methodology, administering it, interpreting it, and then eventually translating it into practice. And I had them, as they were at each of those stages working, ask some questions using four worldviews that I gave them so that they could discover how often their own mind was very outdated and how often they would fall back into an outdated understanding, an outdated worldview, and then their research was being affected by it. They were all shocked.
Wow. Okay. So we've got six phases that they were looking at and they were doing research through, and they were using four worldviews. So you've got my attention here. But can I do what you're talking about as I study and lead others? And if so, how do I do that? Like, what do I do? And what do these doctoral candidates do?
You think about that as a matrix, the way you just decided. So these four worldviews, which I will give you, actually, I created five, but for this study, I only did four. And you have across the top of it, you're moving through these phases. So I taught them to watch for their framing perspective and worldview that was bounding what they were allowing themselves to think about and to even study. I want to share these with you, and I'd like to give you these neuroscience practices and research that are being used as a way to show you how it would work.
Got it. I'd like to thank our sponsors who are working with us to examine their own worldviews and how it affects the way of working and management and even their strategy. We have a great sponsor for Business Second Opinion that's pursuing a regenerative path vigorously and transparently. And they are one of my favorite deep business ideas. Using ancient wisdom coupled with modern innovation to give vitalizing beverages that you can be proud of. Their rallying cry is, "We are Rebel." They are a band of revolutionaries for the greater good. They are a modern-day botanical treasure hunters grounded in ancient herbal wisdom, identifying and gathering the very best the plant queendom has to offer. Check out the latest podcast on the responsible entrepreneur, hosted by Carol Sanford, of course, with their CEO, Cheryl O'Loughlin. You can find the link in the podcast show notes below. So how can we actually know our worldview, though?
Well, you have to have a framework to look at it from, because a very oldest worldview came about at the time when power was being consolidated in the hands of kings and queens, actually, in many cases, also in the church. And it was driven by the idea that people were born to rule and to lead, and that they had a family which had intelligence and passed it along. And even in the church, for a long time in the Catholic Church, you were supposed to be a descendant of the founder of the Catholic Church, or since you couldn't be a descendant of Jesus. That drove this idea of rulers and church power, and usually ordained by God. They were all ordained and they had the power. So we have little less of that, assuming that there are certain people which are born to rule. But it also often shows up in the methodologies where we'll study people we consider like gifted children. And we've made an assumption somehow that because they are smart and very in certain things, that therefore they are gifted. So I'm today not going to pay quite as much attention to that. But one example would be this lineage of intellectual families with higher IQs. And thank goodness people are using this list. The second worldview that emerged centuries later is what might be called the machine worldview. And it became dominant in the first and second industrial revolution. Its foundation is in the belief that humans are like machines. You have to import energy into them. Everything has to come from the outside. You have to create structures like you would for a machine. They can't be self-fueling. They can't be self-understanding. The machine has to have gasoline, and it needs to have that in order to get the productivity working. Well, you have to do the same thing with humans. You focus on their labor. And of course, we've talked about before here the scientific measurement or Taylorism from Frederick Taylor. And it was based, just to remind folks, on the idea that humans are machines, and therefore science studies them like they're machines. And they frame everything around this worldview, and they source everything about they're going to study based on just holding that you can't change these people. They're just kind of fixed. So they're not neutral. As there are many studies that use this scientific method, they later displaced some of this worldview, and it fell slight, or actually they displaced, I guess it is the worldview, but they displaced this way of designing work, but it's still prevalent in the research that we do. Some people just don't move along from this. So the first question that people have to start to ask is, are they using machine worldview and how it is they're bringing things about? And if your few clues is, if you see that all of the research being done and maybe even the intervention is on time and motion studies or assembly lines that are removed or in the outcome, it takes into account everything except the people because they're just a part of the machinery. So most manufacturing has given this up, but the research is still using a fixed view of humans.
So I think what I hear is that these collective worldviews people hold, well, they're holding them unconsciously, it sounds like, a lot of the time, guide much of their thinking. I think I've experienced aspects of this before in healthcare in particular. So for example, when I would see a nurse in a hospital that I used to work at, they were taught problem solving in nursing school. And so there was nothing really wrong with that. And it's helpful in many ways. But in many cases, a lot of the underlying causes of health concerns are more subtle and systemic. In other words, harder to discern, kind of like what you're talking about. So this parts and pieces view of people, which is really another version of the machine paradigm, I think, leads to regular misdiagnoses and healthcare being more reactive than proactive. So how would I be able to know if this is the worldview of a particular study or a research paper that it comes from?
Well, you will hear people describing humans as kind of interchangeable parts. And by that, I mean, they're kind of all alike. And you can say, they will say humans or workers, and they'll be digging into some study, but they'll be extrapolating anything they find or do as though all humans are alike. You know, they created teams for a long time where you would have rotating teams as though it didn't matter who was doing anything. So we get more of that worldview when we're looking at people as being fixed, interchangeable, and it's like some kind of average that fits the whole. And we'll get to that a bit more when we get to the worldviews 4 and 5. We'll come back and reference this one again. you also will see another thing, which is the studies that are done are based on isolated variables. So you'll take out the attitude of humans, or you'll take out their motivation or their decision making, and you'll narrow it down. You won't look at anything except that one thing, and you hold it steady. So it's a part of something, not a whole of something. And then everything else is held as fixed. So the research will actually look at motivation as though you could study it independent. That's actually the way neuroscience is. It's based on isolating the brain and just how it processes things. And they don't look at the ability of humans to actually be able to affect how they're processing. They assume that it's fixed, it's in this isolated variable, and you can understand it all by just looking at the brain. So there are a group of practitioners in this neuroscience world which really are working with the ideas of taking into management ideas that are fixed on humans that are fixed and they're average and they all can be interchangeably exchanged.
So what are the implications of actually trying to isolate different parts of people in this way, or even isolating individuals in this way? And what gets lost? What's missing when we do that, Carol?
Well, I don't know about you, but I don't believe you can study my attitude or my motivation separate from my state of being. On days that I am really distraught, my attitude goes downhill with it. And it may have nothing to do with me being kind of unable to manage my attitude. It may have to do with I'm sick or I've just had an incredibly bad piece of news. But we don't know how to study humans as participating in systems. And people can't create a separate study because scientific method always has you working on this one piece. So, for example, emotional intelligence is one that people try and separate out, and then they treat as though it's the overarching variable. So when people tell you, no, this will solve everything, but they studied one variable, nope, the odds are good that it will not. So we end up missing things if we took, I know Stephen Covey wrote the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Practice. That's not the last word, but, and then he decided it would fit something else and something else. And the thing is that the averaging that we do is though study of one thing can be extrapolated is one that leaves out so much. Design thinking is now doing that, which is really just a makeover of problem solving. All of those are machine-based thinking, and they try and fix problems which are within what is called design thinking rather than understanding the working of people in a whole system. And we'll get to that later. Did that help?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I have this image. It's like I'm walking through Barnes and Noble and I'm walking through the, you know, the all these rows of books, but I'm specifically in the business and management section. And it's like each section is an isolated subject that can be worked on in an isolated way. And each one eventually tries to prove that they're new and more comprehensive and shinier and all these other kind of things. So anytime we have one variable or one study or one subject with one program, we've started from a machine worldview. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Absolutely. That's a great image, walking through a bookstore and seeing all of those different subjects. And most of them will have either some kind of research behind them or a hypothesis, and they can't see that they have seen that they could explain people, just a few of them, and extrapolate that. More likely what people do when they try and use those books is they begin to try and ameliorate what's not quite working out of that supposedly view that's overall for everything. And the hard part is that once you've started with the machine worldview, all you can really do is ameliorate, compensate, you know, accommodate, and you suddenly keep dropping off aspects that come into question and need to be modified, need to be compensated for, need to be problem solved, and can't see that it was the fundamental worldview premise that you started with, the hypothesis that you had an answer and that then it would work. The other thing that's always been strange to me is when people figure out maybe that what they've got isn't whole enough, they do just keep trying to pad on and they drag along all the fragments of the old era, that pulling in a little bit of royalty. I mean, like the reason we've got hierarchies is there's research actually proves people need other people to tell them what to do. Well, if you look at just one isolated impact, you could prove that. but it leaves out all of the things about humans. In fact, there's an era, which we've also talked about before here, that John Watson created, the behavioral worldview. He was a cognitive psychologist, and he railed against this machine view, mostly because he could see that it wasn't sufficient for these industrialists, you know, like the J.P. Morgans of the world, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Mellon. All of these guys were running these big assembly lines and manufacturing facilities. And so he convinced them that the biggest problem they had was they couldn't manage their people in the same way they could as machines, because they were managing them like machines and they weren't machines. So he was able to bring to them the idea, if we could study other living little creatures, rats, that we would be able to talk about it and understand it then. But the behavioral worldview is a different worldview than the machine worldview. And I think right now, these two combined are the most prevailing and pervasive worldview in research and in practice, including neuroscience.
So this whole idea, I mean, I think we've touched on this before, but this whole idea, the study of rats, whether it's, you know, publishing and adopting those findings as answers to human behavior, it underlies a lot of research and design of kind of what goes into business school offerings and social science at universities. It's pretty creepy at the end of the day, to be honest with you. So how can we recognize this worldview of practices and research that gets promulgated as scientific and therefore true? Right. So I'm not quite sure I can always see the design behind it. So I guess I'm curious really about the guidelines.
Sure. No, it's a very reasonable question. And of course, it's something I love doing. People who've hung around me for a while know that I'm always going back and researching the history of how an idea got to be popular. Where did it come from? Where did it get moved into management practice? So you should be asking people, where did this stuff come from? And if they say, well, it was studied in a lab. All right, now you already know you're in trouble, because you pull something out of its living system. You're probably looking at part of a human, an isolated variable. And the underlying idea then is that you've got to externally influence or manipulate either with the behavioral model or with the environment being changed. If it's behavioral and you see that they're talking about in their research, reinforcement, incentives, rewards, you know, extinguishing bad behavior, or talking about feedback, which is part machine and part behavioral. If you can find out that that's what's behind it, asking them, then you'll know a whole lot, because you'll know that they're not looking at the whole of something. And they will assume that these little isolated interventions they can do will get the results. So it's going to show up in leadership and management research, but you got to grill people on where in the world did this come from? Including, you'll discover a few of them have, well, some wise people came up with, so we may be back to the royalty view. There's some other pieces that might be helpful. Many of the offerings from the behavioral view are actually now look a lot more like what I call kinder and gentler versions of behavioral science. So the Neuro Leadership Institute has got new versions of how you can do feedback, new versions of how you can do performance review. And they're basically trying to tell people to ask for feedback, ask for their performance review. And therefore, it would be, you know, not as hard to take. So that's an amelioration of something that is based on the idea that humans have to be externally managed and that they can't figure out things for themselves. We're going to keep coming to that in the era of 4 and 5 of worldview, because that's not true. It's based completely on false premises that were, quote, proven in the behavioral research. And of course, the real problem was John Watson didn't believe that people could see. So he said, no, we're not going to study that because we can't see it. So you get all of these people who are modifying, changing things around a little bit. But the machine and the behavioral worldview are so strong, I find people all the time arguing with me. Well, I've gotten so much from what people have told me. I've got a new book that'll be out very shortly called No More Feedback. And that book is going to be about what it is we need to do to create consciousness in organizations and be able to move to a self-governing worldview that the humanists brought about. And it's not about being less harmful. So these worldviews, the machine, the behaviorists, I mean, stuff that came out of Taylorism, were very slow to let go of them. And just for a second, if I could, back to the neuroscience folks, they're offering an interpretation of brain science with a behavioral worldview still as part of the frame, even though they say they're not. You can tell that they're doing that because of the assumed external stimulation required. The managers have to do something. You have to redesign the work environment. The interventions have to come from outside. So you can tell that's what they're doing, even though they're saying we're not doing behavioral. But it's still external. It still has individuals who they believe can't see themselves. It's a 100-year-old idea, which is very hard to set aside and to embrace self-governing worldview. But, I have to say, I understand why the Neuro Leadership Institute still offers ideas that are permeated with the behavioral view. Their clients, like the wonderful gentleman who asked the question, are still operating from those first two worldviews. And you probably can't keep a job if you keep telling them what they believe is not true.
Yeah. So if I'm understanding these first two worldviews, they're based in understanding people as they are and how they respond to what is and how we want them to be, all the while improving what already exists or what is. So it sounds like a lot of doing better at the end of the day. So giving people more skills, but not able to fundamentally change very much, especially from the machine view. It does not really see people as developable. It really sees them as not really able to change themselves at a deep level, not able to respond in a way that the brain test has shown. So the behavioral and the machines kind of worldviews see people as fixed, and we can design to accommodate those brain determines events and reactions, etc. So you're really just seeking with the research to understand these brain determined responses. You're kind of set up that way from the beginning. You know, the idea of how people function in each circumstance and then how the brain functions, and extrapolate that to all people, and they're now, this is how they're going to be and in perpetuity. So we can define a perfect way to work with them. This goes back to an idea, this idea of ideals that we've talked about before. So organizations teach managers how to accommodate, not really develop people at the end of the day, much less each person individually as the later two worldviews. Am I getting this right?
Absolutely. So I think you've made a really important distinction here. The first two worldviews really see people as doing as well as they can with a few things that we can do to maneuver them, trigger them less, put things in place. The second two worldviews believe that humans are kind of born incomplete and that they are nowhere near having realized the potential, the contribution, even the level of intelligence measured by IQ, and certainly with confidence who they are in terms of their positioning in the world. These two worldviews are really shocking. There is a middle worldview, which we've talked about a bit before, which Carol Dweck did on growth, where you can grow people. And most of that's with new knowledge and new practice. But this, the level, particularly the fourth level worldview we're talking about here, or fifth, I guess it is, fourth and fifth, is really about this deep fundamental shift so that people look back and say, I don't even feel like the same person. I don't even have the same sense of myself and what I could do. I feel like I have grown enormously and I've changed fundamentally at some deep level. But on the other hand, I feel like I'm closer to who I really could be. You know, it just occurs to me with this last thing you did, it would be really helpful, I think, if we took some writings of the people who are writing at these first two worldviews. And I pulled up some by David Rock, the co-founder of the Neuro Leadership Institute, one he wrote in Harvard Business Review, February 22nd, 2018. And this reference and link will be in the show notes. That article was entitled, Tell Employees What You Want Them to Strive For, as in few words as possible. And then there's another one, the Strategy and Leadership Journal, August 27th, 2009. That article is entitled, Managing with the Brain in Mind. Now, again, I want to remind people, this is not about the intentions of the Neuro Leadership Institute. I'm working here on teaching people to be discerning using their work because I have complete faith in the good intentions of not only David Rock, but all the people who are there. But I do believe they could take their work a lot further if they had the capability and the ability to understand their own worldview at each of these six stages as they're taking research and moving it into practice, or as they're doing the research and moving it into practice. And by the way, we all have to go through all of these as we're trying to research and figure things out. So it's important to know that we're probably influencing it if we could see it before we espouse something. So for example, the February 22nd article, Tell Employees What You Want Them to Strive For. All right. It sounds like it says, be clear and direct, avoid confusion to most people. So people say, what's wrong with that? But the title gives us so many clues about the worldview or the perspective of how they're interpreting this research and the design they're using for application. So it speaks from a worldview of the idea that people need to be filled up. You need to give them input about what you're expecting to aspire to. So you have an energy import from the outside. That's a machine worldview. In order for them to know how to proceed and how to be focused. A machine view of a closed system, which is another thing I could say about a guideline for machine, it's closed. It cannot determine its own path. It doesn't. It needs something brought in from the outside. And so the title itself exposes the worldview.
So Carol, this has been a super rich and full conversation today. And I want to make sure people join us for part two. So what are we going to cover next time?
Well, I'm glad we decided to split this into two, because I think what today we've done is given people an overview of the first two paradigms with hints on the other two that are to come, and hopefully tantalizing hints. But before we get to those last two, on the next recording, we're going to take a specific article or writings of someone and show you how to examine it by showing you how I see these worldviews showing up in people's language and the offerings and ideas that they come with. And I think it'll make it really concrete for people.
For more on these worldviews, check out a recorded talk that Carol did recently at the University of Washington. You can find that link in the show notes for episode 118, part one. But since we are referencing the show notes, let me thank our Business Second Opinion show notes sponsors, NumiT, one of the courageous ones that continues to ask a question and examine themselves and their ways of working. Through authenticity, creativity, and commitment to people and planet, NumiT brings you the purest, best-tasting organic tea. See more about their full-leaf flavor teams and 36 other options. My favorite is definitely their green teas. I was a longtime fan, long before they were a sponsor, and I feel deeply in integrity with supporting them now and them us. So go ahead and pick your favorite and check out their website. You can also find that link in our show notes. I also finally want to invite people to call and tell us what they're seeing in terms of their worldviews at work in their world, at a job, a company they lead or own, or work in with students and clients. Leave a message on a Google Voice number with a question that you have that you've been wrestling with at 650-265-1193. That's 6502-HUMAN. It is likely that you would remember that. This has been Business Second Opinion.